Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Luis Rodriguez, writer in many genres, activist, the former poet laureate of Los Angeles. We're going to talk about really all of his thinking and his latest book, From Our Land to Our Land. And you can learn more about Luis's work and his writings and so on at his website, luisjrodriguez.com. All one word, and I'm going to spell it for you. L-U-I-S-J Rodriguez, R-O-D-R-I-G-U-E-Z. LuisJRodriguez, one word, .com. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net. TerrenceMcNally.net. As we continue to confront the coronavirus pandemic, I encourage you to do your part by social distancing, wearing your mask in public, staying home, getting vaccinated, and by finding ways to help those in your community hurt most by the social isolation and the economic devastation. I wrote to Luis Rodriguez this past December asking if he'd be willing to do an interview. I'd been aware of his work for years, and I wouldn't be surprised if we've met either through theater or progressive circles here in LA. I told him I'd like to get his sage take on the city, the state of the nation, and the state of Latinx people and culture in all three as we emerge from the Trump presidency. He agreed to do it, and his publisher, Seven Stories Press, sent me a copy of what turns out to be his first book of essays, From Our Land to Our Land, and I discovered that he was considering things at a level deeper than I'd asked. Grounded in his native roots, he was calling for humanity to reconcile with nature and for each of us to reconnect with ourselves, each other, and the divine. I believe we face a number of existential crises at this moment, and his call certainly rings true to me. Luis Rodriguez is a novelist, memoirist, children's book writer, essayist, and poet, a community and urban peace activist, a youth and arts advocate, founding editor of Tia Chucha Press, co-founder president of Tia Chucha's Centro Cultural and Bookstore in the San Fernando Valley, and from 2014 to 2016 serves as the official poet laureate of Los Angeles. His 16 books include Always Running, La Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A., and It Calls You Back, An Odyssey Through Love, Addiction, Revolutions, and Healing. And his latest, From Our Land to Our Land, Essays, Journeys and Imaginings from a Native Chicanx Writer. He hosts the podcast, The Hummingbird Cricket Hour, with his wife, Trini. Welcome, Luis Rodriguez, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
Well, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, March 2nd. So, first of all, how are you? How is your family? How are you coping with the pandemic?
Well, thank you for asking because, you know, it's really hit hard our communities. And I'm talking about these Mexican Central American communities that I happen to live in. We are actually in ground zero for COVID. The Northeast San Fernando Valley is the second largest Mexican Central American community in the country, and we happen to have the worst number of cases in the county that has more cases. NBC did a whole national show on this and interviewed me about the situation. So yeah, it's gotten pretty bad, but on the other hand, me and my family are doing well. We're safe. I got my two vaccines. My wife got it too. We're waiting for my sons who are here living there until their time comes up, but we're just, like you say, be safe. We don't go out. We minimize it. It's all masks, you know, social distance. You know, we're doing all this Zoom stuff now. So that's where I'm at now, doing Zoom classes and calls and meetings and readings.
And for someone like you, I'm sure, who has been such a piece of the fabric of your community, this is a very different way to have to do things without the face-to-face connection that that's yeah, this rich is to a us very, as humans.
Exactly. And plus, these communities is very interactive. People hang, people out in the street, people. Now it's been minimal. And but I think we're going to get through this. And we went through quite a year of up and down, backwards and forwards, political interferences, things that shouldn't have been brought in. But I think we're starting to make a turn. So I'm praying and hoping for the best.
Yeah. Obviously, the half a million plus dead is, you know, would not have happened with better leadership, better competence, less prejudice, all of those things. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. And, I mean, you've written two memoirs, so you've thought about this a lot. But can you tell us a bit about how you see your path to the work that you do these days?
Well, let me try to summarize it, because two memoirs is too hard to summarize. But let me summarize it.
Of course,
I think, like most people, I was a particularly sensitive, imaginative kid, young child. You know, how there's all, they think that's the realm of just the women, but there's a lot of men who are sensitive and imaginative. But, you know, you grow up in a rough neighborhood. That's like the worst thing that a boy can be. You know what I'm talking about. They want you to play outside. They want you to play sports. They don't understand when you want to rather be in your own room playing with your army men and your trucks. And, you know, it was rough. And I paid a big price for just being this kind of quiet, inward kid. I got jumped when I was 9 years old because they actually caught me, and I don't mind saying it because it's in the book, playing with dolls with my next door neighbor, an 8-year-old girl. I was nine, I think. And they caught me playing dolls. I didn't think twice about it. I had played dolls with my sisters before. It wasn't a big deal, but I did it on the porch. These little tough homies were walking by. They were the same age as me, but they were walking by and they looked at me and laughed. Oh, I got hell. And so I grew up with, I got beat up and my chin got cracked. My jaw got cracked. I've always had a dislocated jaw since then. A little, growth. I never got it fixed. So growth came in and my jaw's crooked. I only got, to this day, three places where my teeth meet. I was made fun of. I was called monkey by girls. I was a constant. And then when they beat me up, it was totally humiliated. But here's what happens to some people. I made a promise that I would never, ever again be humiliated like that. In 2 years, I joined a gang. And the gang embraces you, your chin. I became chin from the gang. That became my moniker. I became a tough guy, fighting everybody. I got arrested for a number of things, but the most prominent things was violence. I was in a murderer's row when I was 16. Murders I didn't do, but I was in, there was a big riot and I happened to be very active in that riot. And then I also was arrested for attempted murder. I have stabbed people. I have shot people. By the grace of every power in the world, I never killed nobody. I have been shot at half a dozen times and never got hit. I can't explain that in the world that I was in. People get shot once or gone. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But somehow I survived it. And what happened is I had a mentor. And this is why mentors to me become important, who saw the artist, saw that sensitive kid underneath that tough facade. And I don't want to say facade, because you couldn't just play being tough. When you're sitting in a murder's row at 16, you can't pretend. You know, you have to really be tough. But what's nested in you is that part that you had from the beginning. And so he was able to draw it out. I learned to paint murals. I ended up going back to school, which was good because I had dropped out. I ended up becoming a writer, as you know. I ended up becoming the kind of sensitive person I was, but now on a higher level.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's what's in the real summation of that story. My whole struggle since then is to stay that whole person. I'm tough. I can go anywhere. I've been working in prisons for 40 years.
Yeah.
I go to the roughest neighborhoods. I ain't scared of nobody or nothing. On the other hand, I am a very sensitive person. I do things strategically. I try to connect with people in respectful, dignified ways. I don't use violent means to get over. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you do learn. And that's, I think, is a summary of this young person trying to find his way back, but on the higher level, which is an important part. I'm not going to go back to that 8-year-old, 9-year-old kid that was locked in his room playing with toys. But I couldn't lose a poetic part of me that is now, as you know, part of who I am.
Wow. Yeah, it's really something. In other words, too many people would either, well, I think it runs throughout your writing and your thinking. We are presented with false choices.
Yes.
And one of those false choices is you can't be tough and strong and sensitive and poetic.
There you go. That's the most beautiful way of saying it. I mentioned this to a nephew of mine who's a tough guy, hardworking guy, construction, you know, he's a nephew, no big deal. And I mentioned that story and he started to snicker. It was like the funniest thing, but I looked at him and I gave him one of those long prison looks. It's like, don't think that means, you know, I'm not capable of whatever you think I'm not capable of.
Right.
And he kind of stopped himself and he goes, listen, man, you carry all of it. I just have chosen that I don't need to go there anymore. I don't need to fight people like I used to physically fight people. I used to shoot people. I have no guns no more. I do other things, but man, don't push me. Don't put me against the wall. It's like Michael Mead. If you know Michael Mead, he's the same way.
Yeah.
He grew up in Queens and these rough Irish neighborhoods, Irish Italian neighborhoods. He got beat up a lot. He can withstand a lot, but he used story. And story wins most battles for him. And that's what's important, you know.
Yeah, let me just say for listeners, Luis is referring to Michael Mead, M-E-A-D-E, and Michael is a poet, a mentor, a visionary, and has been working with young men and men for decades. And a lot of Michael's work, and I'm going to, because you brought him up, I'm going to ask you about this, deals with initiation and rites of passage and so on. How do you feel those ideas, initiation, rites of passage, show up in the story you just told of your own life?
Well, when you don't do it consciously with community, you end up doing it just because of the traumas and batterings of your life. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And you get initiated whether you know it or not. Now, you may not be as conscious of it, which is always the struggle to be aware. Even joining a gang was an initiation. It wasn't community-led. It wasn't properly done. But even giving me a new name is part of what happens, especially with indigenous people from around the world. They rename people. They take into the stages of their growth and development, and they let you know, they get you to be self-aware of what is happening inside your psyche, inside your soul. And I think the gang was doing that in their own crazy, weird way. but of course, with the gang, the limitations of a gang, you go to prison and that's the end of it.
I mean,
what else are you going to do? You got to be the toughest guy in prison, but that's the end of it. You don't realize that life has many, many more unfoldings to happen. And that's what initiation does. It helps you get through every aspect of your life. So at the very end, when you make that return, as Joseph Campbell talks about, after going through all these ordeals, you either curse or bless the community. And if you become, quote, a real hero, a hero of yourself, of your own capacities, you bless the community with what you learn.
Let's talk. I really appreciate that. One thing that came up for me as you were mentioning that about the names, and you may relate to this as well, I don't know. I was brought up Catholic, and I remember that confirmation, which is that one that happens at about 12 or 13, you take a new name.
Right. That's exactly right. I think it's natural for people because, I don't know if you know, but the Aztecs, Mexicas, they will give you a new name every 13 years.
Oh, yes, so, I learned about this from your writing. It was quite fascinating. They actually thought you became a new person every 13 years.
Yeah, so then you have to get a new name. And that's good because you're carrying those energies that now you're able to move through or tap into. And that's important. I think if we pay attention to these, you realize that all human beings go through these thresholds. We may not say 13, sometimes we say every dozen years, but it doesn't matter. You go through these thresholds in your life, and a new name just means it's a recognition. You're not the same person as you were before. You might, it's all nested in you, but now you're going through a whole new development. And that's important to point out for anybody, especially young people.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk just a little bit more. We talked about your personal experience, your community experience of the pandemic, but the pandemic as crisis, as metaphor, as crucible, what do you sense we may have experienced or learned about essential workers, about who's essential, about right. health and security inequities, about shared yeah. vulnerability, that the rich can die of COVID just as the poor can die of COVID. They right. may get the vaccination sooner, but right. at some level we are all vulnerable to this, as we are all vulnerable to climate crisis and things like that. What do you think are some of the lessons or hopes, at least, that we might draw from going through this together?
Well, I guess you can call this a collective initiation.
Mm.
We're all going through this as a people, as a world. And what it does, it forces us to have to look at some essential things, including that we are all connected, all human beings. We've been so detached and alienated from each other, from so many things, that it's important to realize that no matter what you think, we're all connected. And that's important. The other thing that I think it points out is that everything is alive. The world is alive, the earth, everything. We tend to think of people being alive and maybe animals. Everything, even that's stuck and seems like it's stuck, it's got some living energy. And that's important because that means that what infuses us with what we call life infuses the whole world we're in. And that means it's becoming clear to me, I think, and also to a lot of people, that we have to take care of this world if we're going to take care of each other. You can't separate the two things. You can't say America first and not realize that if you take care of the whole world, that includes America. You know what I mean? But why America first? And it really ends up undermining America. But the other point, other people suffer while America gets all the resources, whatever. But even America can't make much of it because it's not right. You take care of the whole world. You make sure everybody's basic needs are met, their basic psychic needs, their basic emotional needs, their physical needs, spiritual needs, and then you move forward as a world. It doesn't mean you wait for everybody, but you basically make sure, like they always used to say as a political gamut, leave nobody behind.
Mm-hmm.
That's indigenous, and all indigenous people. That's an old indigenous mind that I think is also nested in us. And we can hopefully draw back those ideas for the world that we're in.
Yeah, and I draw actually a lot in preparing for this from I'd call it an essay, but it was the blog post that you wrote on, I think, January 1st, 2017. Mm. It's quite lengthy, maybe 20 pages or something. But what I saw was going on for you there was this was the new year following Trump's election.
Right.
And it was a taking stock of where we are and where we go and so on. So I will tell you that was something that I really drew on a lot in preparing for this. But one of the things that you've said about the pandemic, so of course you didn't say that then, but it seems to fit, is that it's not time to go back to normal.
Right.
Because normal wasn't good when we left it.
Exactly. I think that's an important point because everybody... Okay, we're at a crossroads about where we're going to go. And again, this is a worldwide phenomenon.
Yes.
And so all of us were facing our politicians. Some are better than others, but for the most part, they're wholly inadequate for what we need now.
Mm.
I don't think this is a politician's only response. I think the world needs to speak up in many ways. I do it the way I can do it. Other people do it on their own. It's a time for a lot of people to step up, whether it's through music, through art, whether it's through speaking, poetry, all kinds of ways to speak up. And I'm not downing politicians. Those that get it and they can speak up very vividly about where we're at should do so. But I don't think this is just the answer, put it in the hands of, I don't care what administration it's in. I don't think the answer is just going to lie with them. It's going to lie with all of us. And it means all of us looking at ourselves, I know this is a world of conspiracy theories and people believing whatever they want to believe, but there's got to be a commonality that we can draw from. And that commonality can't be the most simplest thing. It has to be something that we can all draw from and then begin to speak on. And that's where I think I'm at now, trying to speak to those common things that all of us have, regardless of what they believe. Belief to me is it's up and down, backwards and forwards. Belief does not sustain. It's what we call knowing. Mm-hmm. You know, really knowing about ourselves and our psychics, and as well as what's going on with the world and where it needs to go.
One thing I we will speak about in a few minutes is something I found quite profound, and I think it really flows through a lot of your work, even if you weren't naming it until recently, which is your thinking about the four connections and the disconnections and the reconnections and so on. But before we do, I wanted to share with you a moment and get your reflections on it, which was following Trump's Electoral College victory in 2016, and I often use that term instead of saying his election,
right, if you will.
Yeah. But I attended a large meeting, I think it was at the California Endowment, nonprofit leaders, community activists, and so on. And people were pretty shell-shocked by the election and the prospects of what lie ahead. And towards the end of what was probably about a two-hour session, a millennial Latina got up, and her words are what I remember from that whole event. She shared that the last time she'd woken up after an election feeling that badly was in 1994. After the passage of California Prop 287,
which
people don't remember now, my guess is most people don't. It was in some ways worse than a lot of what Trump was trying to do. I mean, Prop 287 was harsh.
Yeah, I think it's 187.
Oh, 187?
Yeah.
I think you're right.
And I get that. And you know what happened is we have Tia Chucha's Centro Cultural that you mentioned is a very vibrant cultural space. Right after the election, we had a circle here there because we have a lot of people who are dreamers, undocumented,
sure,
who've been here since they were babies, but now they felt we're going to get deported. And as you know, it did happen during the Trump period. Some of their mothers and fathers got deported. Some of them got deported. They all came together at our center to say, what are we going to do? Most people seemed like emboldened, we're going to keep organizing. But I remember this one young girl, she actually said, I want to kill myself. And it was really, everybody had to stop and just stop everything. Not to jump up and down, oh, don't die, you know, that kind of stuff people want to. But just to take it that in.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we talked as a whole. And then afterwards, we talked to her, so make sure she actually could get whatever help she needed. Because we're mandated, especially for young people, to report anybody that has those kind of issues. She's okay, by the way. But at least it was honest. She had tears in her eyes. And that's the way she felt. That's really extreme, but that's the way people felt. The world was ending. A part of the world was ending. And it was hard for people who don't know, when you don't have papers and you've been treated badly because of it and you grew up that way and you couldn't find a way to get papers. People say, well, get in line, you'll become legal. I said, there is no line.
Yeah, right. You
know, they're making this up. There's no line.
It's a slogan, but it's
exactly
not real. But what I was saying, by the way, Luis, was that she then said that after feeling that way that morning, she said, but look at California now, the bluest state in the nation, progressive toward LGBTQ, progressive toward immigrants.
Right.
And she said she felt, and this was what gave me so much hope, she said, America's going through in 2017 what California went through 25 years earlier.
Well, that's a good point.
And you know, and the arc of history or the arc of justice, you know.
Right.
Which I thought was...
that's amazing. I'm glad you brought that up because I think she's right. We're going through, in the whole country, I think we're going through a change. Again, I think if people just say, let the Democrats do it, it's not going to be enough.
No.
But I think most people are hopefully at the point where we're not going to let Trump happen again. You know, Trump completely lost every battle he was in.
Yes.
And he lost not just the presidency, he lost the House, he lost the Senate. People talk about, well, he ain't a loser. That guy lost everything. And now he's lost the country, really, because the only people that now that he has to really deal with isn't so much America right now, it's Republicans, you know. And right now, that's the battle Republicans have to have. Their Trump problem. It used to be a whole country problem. Now it's their problem.
Mm.
You know, so, and I hope that this is the way it goes, that hopefully the Republicans, regardless of how bad something could be, that they also resolve that by getting rid of Trump. But that's on them. The issue is, I think most of the country is not going to go by back to that. Now, we might still make a lot of mistakes. I found, for example, the Biden administration, especially Biden, to be evolving. Mm-hmm. I found him to be interesting because I never really thought he was going to be that strong. I felt that he just wasn't. But you know what? He's evolved right now to become one of the most progressive presidential candidates. Is he also making mistakes? Yes, as you know, with Khashoggi's murder and everything.
Both moves in the Mideast seem wrong to me.
Yeah, the Syrian
attack and the lack of sanctions, both. But
And that just goes to show there's a lot of work that we have to do to keep putting pressure, to keep fighting for the right things, for the things that we know need to happen, but not to take away that there's some strong, important people in there. I think they've picked up some of the movement that was happening in the country for justice, for systemic change, all these things that we've been talking about, the reset that we've been talking about, especially this past year.
Let me ask you, we won't stay with politics for that much of this, but first of all, let me just say, for people who don't know this, according to the 2019 Census Bureau estimates, the U.S. population is 13.5% Black and 18.5% Chicanos, to use your term. And yet I feel less attention is paid, for whatever reason, to calls for inclusion for brown people than for Black. So that's just one, you know, I mean.
Yeah, and I think that's basically, this is just one point.
Yeah.
I think we have a Black and white binary.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying most people, but a lot of people do. They're stuck there. They don't understand the world as it is. A lot of the Latinx people that you're mentioning, that 18%, include Afro-descended people.
Mm-hmm.
They also include white European-descended people, and they also include a lot of indigenous people,
yes.
I mean, with real tribal connections. So that's what's hard with that population. I think the majority of Mexicans that come here are generally indigenous brown-skinned people, mm-hmm. but that's because they're workers. You know, they're the most suppressed and messed over in Mexico, just like Central America. But then you do have people with money, and they come from the more well-off, light-skinned communities, you know what I'm saying? Latin America is not what people think it is. So I think they have a problem with brown, in that brown is a mixture of all these things. They don't quite know how to put it in perspective when you have a Black and white world.
Yeah. And then the other thing I was going to say was that we saw Georgia basically save the Senate, and most attention was paid by commentators and folks outside of Georgia to the Black community, leaders like Stacey Abrams, voter registration, so on. But my family lives in Atlanta.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I know that the brown community in Georgia is huge and growing.
It's big. It is big.
Yeah, and so I'm sure that it was going on in both communities. And when people look to Texas as the next one that might change, well, obviously, there everyone knows that if Texas shifts, it's because of Latinx people who register and vote in numbers they never did before.
Yeah, I was I did a 10-week residence in North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
And the reason why, this is the year 2000, but there was a 600% rise in the Latinx population there.
Yep.
And it caused a lot of consternation between whites and blacks, all these brown people coming and working in the fields and the tobacco fields. If you know anything about North Carolina, the turkey farms, all this industry.
Poultry, yeah.
Yeah, coming in, and there was so much issue. And I did this great residency. Of course, North Carolina is still within that old Republicans kind of Southern politics, but it's also changing.
It's changing. They've got a Democratic governor.
Just like Georgia, just like some of these other states. And I think that's what it is. And look, I'm going to tell you something, which I'm sure you're aware of. Most Latinx people are conservative people. Just like most, I think most black people are. Maybe not most, but a good number of them. Black people, whatever they might come from, actually a little bit more cohesive. But for the most part, people are conservative. What makes them progressive in this case is the discrimination that they face all the time. And that's what has gelled the Latinx community in the South and other places. And that's what, of course, keeps gelling the black community. The ongoing barriers that they have to deal with is bringing more people together in that sense.
Right. But no, the point that you make first when you said most people may not realize this is religion is stronger in the black community and the Latinx community than it is strong in the white community. And religion tends to be, although we have liberation theology, religion tends to be conservative.
That's very true. Yeah. And that's when some people need to know that. I had a friend from my friend from New Zealand who now lives in London. He wanted to know why all these Latinx, it wasn't that many, but it was enough, like 30, even close to 40% were voted for Trump or something like that. Well, that still means 70 or 80 didn't. But the point is, how come so many? And I say, well, a lot of it is religion.
Yeah.
They just go with the churches, and the churches are definitely, for the most part, not all of them, are definitely more conservative.
Yeah. So let me tell people, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Luis Rodriguez, writer in many genres, activist, and the former poet laureate of Los Angeles. We're talking about everything, but some of it about his latest book, From Our Land to Our Land. And you can learn more about his writings and his work at his website, luisjrodriguez.com. One word, Luis, L-U-I-S, J, Rodriguez, R-O-D-R-I-G-U-E-Z, luisjrodriguez.com. I saw John Leguizamo's Latin History for Morons at the theater. In fact, I was the guy in the front row that he picked on.
Oh.
You know what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
He chooses one person.
Yeah. Is this the one that showed up on the TV?
It was. That wasn't the one I was at, but it was at the Amundsen downtown. And my wife and I happened to get front row seats, and it's like three or four times during the show where he puts me on the spot. And what I realized was that no matter what answer I answered to his question, I was wrong.
Yeah.
That's what happens when you write the show. But the show was funny, but, you know, also deathly serious.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you and he both remind us of history that we never learned.
Yeah.
The point that you make is, and most Californians, I'm sure, do not know this, that you say that when the Spanish first arrived in California, there were a million native peoples in what is now California in the 1500s when they arrived. And by the 1700s, when they had solidified the mission system and so on, there were only 16,000 of that million left.
Yes, that is genocide that we know, and it started with the Spanish because people want to Hispanicize all these Latinx people, but we're not Spanish, even if we speak Spanish, and even if we have Spanish names. We, like you say, come in all races and all colors, but they played the big role. The genocide started with them. The mission system actually destroyed a lot of the tribal peoples, lands, and their cultures. And then, of course, when the Americans got in there, they went ahead and had their own genocidal thing, especially around the gold, when the gold was
following the gold rush. Yeah.
Yeah, so that led to, by the 1900s, 16,000 native peoples in California left, which is sad. Now, as you know, those numbers have grown. The native peoples, for the most part, are still here. We have 100 recognized, federally recognized tribal people in California, but their numbers are nowhere near what they should be because of that. And, of course, it's also replenished with native peoples from Michoacán, from Chihuahua, from Oaxaca. Mestecos and Zapotecos are very big in the fields, and many communities, and Mayans from Guatemala and Mexico. So it's being replenished with native peoples from other parts of the continent.
And you have either felt or chosen to identify very much with that aspect of your
And as you know, I didn't grow up that way.
Heritage, yeah.
I grew up like you, Catholic. I grew up in Watts, and then the poorest part of the San Gabriel Valley, which is hard to point because it's Hanging River Valley's changed a lot, but I was there when it was dirt roads, you know, little shacks. It looked like Appalachia, only more densely populated when I was growing up there. But I didn't grow up indigenous. The only thing that kept me going is my mother. She kept telling us we're Tarahumaras, which is a very important tribal people. They call themselves Rarámuri in Chihuahua, Mexico. Huge tribal people. They're the ones that are famous for running, you know, with their sandals and beating everybody, except the Kenyans. You know, the Kenyans are the best runners in the world. Yeah. But Tarahumaras are up there. And very few Mexicans do that. She kept telling us, don't forget your Tarahumaras. That was very important for me. I didn't grow up traditional Native. I didn't understand it. But when I was an adult, my struggle was to find that heritage, to go back to that. Again, I'm not tribal. No tribe can recognize me, except that I went back to Tarahumara land. I went back to the Copper Canyon. Beautiful place, which if anybody, there's a really beautiful book called Born to Run by Christopher McDougall, which is a beautiful book that includes, I think, an honoring of those people. But it's beautiful to be there and to get embraced by them, which they did. At first, they wouldn't recognize me because they say, I look Mexican. They don't consider themselves Mexican. They're Rarámuri, they're Tarahumaras. But once they told them I was looking for my roots, that my mother, my grandmother, great-grandmother, all these connections, they said, fine. They opened their doors. And you know why? They told me because nobody comes back.
Mm-hmm.
Said, nobody comes back. You're the only one that we've heard that wants to know who you are. So then they became very beautiful and embraced me and brought me into their home. Many of them live in caves. There was, at the time, 80,000 of them living in caves in the Copper Canyon. I got the chance to go into their homes. They don't invite nobody, but they did. And so I decided to go back to my native roots, and I've been doing that ever since now for more than 25 years. Actually, I have to say Michael Mead played a role in this, because when I first started going around the Mint's mosaic things, he had Maladoma Somme, he had Jack Hornfield, you know, he had me, he had others, and we were all talking about the indigenous roots of these ideas, of these concepts, and it helped, because that's the same time that I decided I'm going to find my roots.
How did your return to your roots coincide with getting sober?
Well, it definitely coincided. What it was is I went through a recovery program, but I had a problem with it. Without really naming it, it was too Western oriented.
Mm.
And again, I'm not against that. I'm not against AA, NA, or any recovery program. But I find them, at least for me, too Western-oriented. Maybe NA, AA, a little bit more of what I find to be organic and better. But still, it wasn't quite. And just at the same time that I was going to these men's conferences, and Michael had me as a teacher, so I was teaching as well as learning. I went back to my roots. I started to also do a lot of work in Native American reservations. I would have to say the two reservations that taught me a lot was Pine Ridge in South Dakota and the Navajo, the Dene Reservation in Arizona. And I met elders there that became my elders. And they helped shape and inform the kind of work that I was going to do from here on in, incorporating the indigenous from all these people, including, of course, I work with Mexicas. I know I was in Oaxaca with indigenous people there. I was in Quechua land up in Peru. I was with the Pipil in El Salvador, Guatemalans, the Mayans. In other words, I connected with tribal people all over. That informs what I do from here on in. And that was really the opening. Michael Mead and that men's work, as well as my own recovery, because I started my recovery in 1993. And in 1994, I was full head on going into my indigenous.
Yeah, so you replaced one form of spirits with another.
Yeah, absolutely. The spirit that I think spoke to me. And again, I'm not against any recovery program. I help take people to NA meetings because anything that helps people.
Right.
But for me, the recovery program connected to the sweat lodge, connected to the medicine, the prayer meetings, all these things that I started to do, that's where I put most of my recovery efforts.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk, as I said before, let's talk about this notion of the four connections.
Yeah.
And what I'm gonna read one thing, a quote that sort of introduces that in one of the things you wrote. I'd like to propose that these disconnections, separation from nature, from our own natures, from each other and the divine, is the greatest source of inhumanity, trauma, and disintegration confronting native peoples today, and I'll venture to say everyone else as well. So lay out for people this vision that you see of the way that our current society and our form of capitalism and so on alienates us, disconnects us, and the path forward that might unfold for us if we can reconnect.
Yes. Maybe we'll start with some mythology, believe it or not.
Sure.
When I learned so much from working with Michael, again, who's an Irish-American. He knows mythology. He studied from all over the world. He has stories from everywhere. I noticed that there was four major things that all these myths were speaking to. Sometimes a combination of them. One is your disconnection to nature. As you know, a lot of stories are about reconnecting to nature. Or your own nature, your own gifts, your own propensities, your own latent talents that you might bring to the world. And also the disconnection from others. Relationships, what does that mean? How do you nurture them? How can they be part of who you are in a good, healthy way? And then the fourth one is with the divine. And if you think of all mythologies, they're pretty much dealing with those four. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And then, of course, when you work with elders like I have among the Lakota or the Diné or the Mexicas or Raramuri, all the people that I've talked to, they also relate the same thing. They talk about the four key connections. And then when you look at history, which again is mixed in with a lot of things that is not as powerful as mythology, but still has something important. And that is when they introduced the doctrine of discovery, when the Spanish got the Vatican and everybody to agree, this new world was going to be in their hands. The first things they went after was those four key connections. You know what I mean?
To break them, you mean?
To break them, to go. If you break this, you will save their souls, which is a crazy, stupid concept, but that's what we have. And again,
you went through that quite quickly, but what you're saying is to break the connections that the native peoples had to nature, each other, self, the divine.
Yeah.
That you're saying the Spanish, the missionaries, felt that the way to salvation was to break those connections. And
absolutely.
That's what, I mean, I just wanted anyone who didn't quite hear that to hear it. Yeah, it's insane.
Yeah, and they were pretty conscious of it, and they were pretty, there was a battles between them. Some of the priests actually didn't like what was going on, but some of them challenged it, but they really couldn't truly break away from the four key connections that were being broken. And so now you see, as you know, if you go to reservations or even among any indigenous people on this land, a lot of trauma and a lot of alienation. There's more suicides. Mm-hmm. There's more drug use, alcohol use. People just feel like they don't belong anywhere, no matter what. And you think, well, these are the people who have been here before anybody else. Not that nobody else belongs, but they're the least that feel they belong. And that, I think, it's what the doctrine of discovery all the way to the present has done. And the struggle now, and again, not just for indigenous people, but, native peoples are struggling to do that. But then you think about it, this has affected all peoples. When your elder systems and everything, Robert Bright talks about this, gets destroyed for the industry, working in a factory. Your father now has to follow the time clock. He doesn't have time to be the father that you should have. Your mother has to be at home, kicking everybody's butt just to keep things in order and cleaning all day long. In other words, we get more alienated further and further from these four important connections. All of us are actually impacted by this. Poverty does that. Drugs, crack coming in, everything. They all contribute to us being disconnected.
No, I let me just say, I agree absolutely. I would say if I've been on, a path for many years, it's very much about exactly what you're talking about. That the way and the way society or capitalism does it keeps changing because we have technological revolutions, but they keep perpetuating those same disconnections, and we end up alienated from our neighbor, and even more so alienated, as you say, from ourselves, from our own creativity, from our own sources.
Right. And you know that if you think about it, Trump, we're speaking about Trump, just took advantage of that. I don't think he has to be that smart to figure it out. He took advantage of all the division, all the alienation, went to a certain section of white people, and I think to their detriment, and says, you know, you're my base.
Yeah.
You know, black and brown people and progressives and lefts, they're the enemy. They're the devil. You know, and he wasn't doing it by himself. This was already laid the groundwork way before he shows up.
Absolutely.
And now you got this country that is seeing that section of white worker that should be united with the rest of us going to war with the rest of us.
Well, as you say, there is no white working class. No. There's a working class.
Yeah, exactly. I know, and I always thought that was weird that they're making a big deal with the white workers. And I go, listen, I worked in that industry. I like a lot of people. I remember that industry. We were all black, brown, and white.
Yeah.
You know, and we worked together. And sure, there was divisions. But on the other hand, it's like they used to say, you know, when you come out, you're all dusty and dirty. You all look the same after that.
I want you to break it down. So disconnection from nature. Yeah. We can see that in the way we relate to the environment. You can look at the impending climate crisis, which is here, the plastics that are everywhere, the air pollution that is worst in communities of poor and of color. That disconnection from nature is not necessary. I mean, I'm making this up as I'm saying it, but it's not necessary to be modern, to take advantage of what we've discovered and invented. It is not necessary that we break our relationship with nature. It helps those who make the most money from that disconnection.
Well, that's the point. People profit a lot from this. And as long as that's, you know, almost all the mythologies also speak, and all scripture does too. Christian scripture, any kind of scripture, speaks against profit being your mode of operation. You know what I'm saying? But yet, that's what we have now. That's the normal mode of operation in this country and, unfortunately, the world. We are about a profit-making system. People are going to profit. There's oil, and people made the case, well, oil must have been there for us to use so we can have this technology. My wife makes a good case, and that I don't think she's the only one, that the oil actually helps the Earth's tectonic plates. It actually helps oil these plates in such a way that when they do rumble, they don't get as devastating because the oil helps move it. But when you pull oil out of the Earth, they don't have that no more. And so earthquakes, as you know, have gotten worse. Mm-hmm. Tsunamis have gotten worse. Hurricanes are building up more. All kinds of things are going on. It's all related. Everything we do matters. And so that's where I think the profit motive of our society, no matter how good people behind it, no matter how people say, well, let's reform this, let's fix this, the basic profit motive of our world isn't freedom, isn't justice for all. It's really how much can I profit? And you can tell because that's how the whole Congress is set up. And even presidents and everybody, they're all making sure. That's why Syria gets bombed and Saudi Arabia's considered our friend. There's profit in that.
Yeah.
You know?
But the other thing that's hooked to that is another thing you speak about, which is that you say nature and those who bond with nature see abundance.
Exactly. If you work with nature properly.
You don't have profit unless you have scarcity.
Right. It's good. This is where it's a very important point. Scarcity is a made-up thing. Just like racism, but racism is powerful. It's made up. The whole idea of racism is made up, as you know. They make this up so there's profit in it. Somebody made the idea that scarcity is real, you know, and this is where, like, all the Republicans, or not just them, but everybody talks about, well, you can't have clean air because it ruins the coal jobs, and these poor workers need coal to work. Well, no, there's other work you can do. In fact, solar energy and other energy hired 3 times more than coal. Actually hired more people, but nobody made that case. they were insisting that we got to have coal.
Yep.
Otherwise, jobs are sacrificed. No, your jobs have to move along with the understanding that you don't need coal no more. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
you
and save as the world. You have to make provision for that transition. You have to
sure.
You have to help people who are in an industry that you're abandoning to transition to the new world. But you don't have to stick to it. You just have to. But if you do it without that, then you create division.
That's where scarcity comes in.
Yeah.
And that's all made up stuff. And of course, that scares people. Scarcity is the biggest scare. I mean, that's why people say, I don't want no illegal aliens in my house.
Right.
It's scarcity.
There's not enough.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. The other thing that you referred to once that I wanted to emphasize was you point out that the native peoples, when they are living traditionally, were healthy. In all sorts of ways. And as they then moved to urban or semi-urban ghettos, then they almost go from being healthy to being the most unhealthy.
You know, and we make a strong point of that. It's in the book, but my mother, who grew up Tarumara, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In her own way, she was still Catholic, but she was in the civilized world. She wasn't in the traditional lands. So she became obese. She had thyroid problems. She had diabetes. She lost all her teeth as a child. I mean, she didn't have any teeth in her 20s. She was just in bad shape. But if you go to the native lands where these people are at, they generally eat the three sisters, corn, squash, and beans. They don't eat meat except in the wintertime when they get the deer and the rabbits and whatever they could. The Spanish brought the goats and the hogs and other things, but they just used those animals to fertilize the fields. And they walk for hours. They are quite healthy. In fact, Duke University and other places have studied why these people don't have heart disease at the level that other people do, why they don't have the diabetes. But as soon as they leave that world, become civilized, quote unquote, now they're sick. Now they got all the problems. Now they're alcoholics. Now they beat their wives and kids.
Yes, it's not just physical health; it's mental health as well.
Everything.
You lose your connection to your source.
There you go.
Yeah. So nature. Then you say our connection to ourselves, our own genius, our calling. I thought that was our destiny.
That's an important part of the initiation discussion too. I mean, everybody has their own nature. So there's nature, but what's our own nature? And everybody's nature specific. We have a common nature, as you know, as human beings, but everybody has their own specific place in it. It's almost like if you don't really fill out yourself in the world the way you were meant to be, there's an emptiness there because only you could have filled it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so if you get that power of I belong in this world and I have a place in this world and it's dependent on me from the inside, not the outside. Not some job telling you what to do, not some boss, not some industry, not some teacher, but really not even parents. It's really you looking at yourself and saying, I love music. I love working with my hands. I love dance. I love thinking with my brain and mathematical problems, whatever it might be. You know, this is your calling. This is what you were meant to do. And you contribute in that field in your own way, your own personal imprint. That's your own nature. That to me is missing. We tend to be homogenized, you know what I mean? And we tend to be pushed into areas, whether we like it or not. I know that I was supposed to end up in living in the LA area in industry. All the Mexicans in all the high schools that I went to were all geared to that. All the Mexicans were in the industrial classes.
Yeah.
You know, there were one or two that went up in the academic classes, but most of them were stuck in wood shop, auto shop, you know, print shop. And I did all those classes. I wanted to be more than that. I wanted to study writing. I wanted to study. I read books. No, there was no place for you. And so that's what I'm saying. Other people determine who you are when it's really a soul determination.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned some of there's a greeting in one of the native languages that basically says your destiny.
Yeah, Kuali Tonali, which means a good day. But Tonali actually means destiny.
Mm-hmm.
And so it also means the sun, and is related to the sun. So it's like Guaritanari means a good day, a good day with the sun. But the sun is related to your destiny. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like what they're saying. Have a good destiny.
Yes. Okay, then there's the connection to each other, which you point out, the golden rule, basically.
Yeah, and you know, I put in here, this has got me actually a good audience with prisoners. I've been teaching in prison for 40 years. And I raise this to them because there's a lot of Christians there, and I have no issue with Christians. I might have issues with churches, but I don't have no problem with Catholics, Christians, even evangelicals. But here's what I tell them. Is all your scripture trying to get you to be a good Christian? And of course, they always say, yeah. And I go, no. Your scriptures, your teachings from Christ is trying to get you to be a decent, whole, and complete human being. Mm-hmm. And they look at me and they go, well, let's talk about this. Even the red road that I'm on, the indigenous red road, we call it, does not mean I'm trying to be a good Indian.
Yeah.
I'm trying to be a decent, whole, healthy human being. The red road is my way of doing that. The Buddhist road, you know, all the principles in Buddhism, they're all trying to get you to be that kind of whole, complete, decent human being so you can move into your next level of development, which eventually becomes nirvana, you know. In other words, every religion has that. Even Muslim, the Quran is nothing but filled with how to be a better human being. I said, that is the goal of all of them. Now, of course, if you're Christian and you're a better, decent, truthful, you know, human being, you're going to be a good Christian. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And the final one, the fourth connection, disconnection, is the divine. Let me give you 1 minute to talk about that one, and then we got to bring the conversation to a close.
You know, with the Navajo, the Diné, they say, if you look at your hand, you see the physical part, but in between the fingers is an empty space. And what they say, that's some reminder that there's another unseen world. And that's important for almost all peoples. They all recognize that there's an unseen world beneath, below, or around the world that we can physically see. And we call it spirit, you can call it anything. You know, I'm connecting to this energy that I can't see, but I know is there. That's the divine, however you want to name it, you know, whatever you want to call it, it's up to you, because I think religions are basically human-made. Mm-hmm. But they're all trying to speak to that. And we call it the great mystery. I'm saying Native people, it's a mystery. We don't have to name it even. We call it the mystery of what is underneath everything that we do, what keeps us going. And also, even though we're materially different from other beings, we are actually connected through the spirit. This is how we see things. So I tell people, find a way to have that spiritual engagement, connect to the divine, and the way that speaks to you. But you got to have it, because I think a lot of the big alienations is people being completely taken away from the divine. And I also propose that churches do that. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say that churches won't do that, because churches are supposed to keep you connected. But I find too many churches don't have the divine in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't take you to the deepest source.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, we got to bring it to a close, Luis. This is
great.
Wonderful.
I know we could talk for hours
we
and
could.
Hours. I know.
We could. The new book is From Our Land to Our Land, Essays, Journeys, and Imaginings from a Native Chicanx Writer. The website, and it's a good website, links to his podcast, his writings, and so on, is luisjrodriguez.com. Luis, L-U-I-S, J, Rodriguez, R-O-D-R-I-G-U-E-Z, all one word, .com. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, all one word. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement, it tells you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 or 10 relevant, timely articles, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, @mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform Podcast at Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and most of the major podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts there or at my site. At my site, they're searchable by guest, which is not true at all the podcast sites. And you'll find there Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Luis Rodriguez. Keep up your good work.
Thank you. I had a great time.